Okay, so I thought I'd talk about the small nerves because they get short shrift and they're very important when patients are complaining about them. Otherwise, they just do their own job. Here are the objectives of this talk and see me if we haven't met one of them afterwards. So we're going to try to localize disorders affecting the small fiber system. We'll describe what's known about epidemiology, which is very little, about two slides worth. And then I have a couple of cases in which I really want to try to help connect symptoms and pathogenesis. Then we'll talk a little bit, we won't spend much time on autonomic testing. I've got the slides here, but I think we'll skip through it because most people in this room know. But I just put it by way of review. And then we'll talk about diagnosis and management. So just reviewing the small fiber system, recall that you actually have, actually this only shows two systems, there's actually three, keep in mind there are actually three sensory systems. So sensory system number one I'm talking about today, is this the laser? Great. Sensory system we're talking about today is the anterolateral system, which is C fiber, which then comes through the dorsal roots, comes through the dorsal horn, and please recall it, it crosses fairly promptly synapses and then goes up. So if you think about that, why do you ever have a synapse in the nervous system? So you can either amplify or modify the signal. So contrast this with the large fiber system that goes through the posterior columns, which you don't have a synapse. So clearly, the nervous system is interested in modifying this signal early and using it early, whereas the nervous system is really not that interested in modifying or either amplifying or reducing this signal. It wants to know what's going on in the system. So the only point of this, I just want to emphasize, where we have a synapse, and you can actually turn this off using the descending modulating system, you can never turn this off, no matter how hard you try. Now the third, I said there are three systems. The third system we sometimes forget about is there's a cerebellar sensory system that does not go to consciousness, just provides proprioception to cerebellum. This in the old anatomy textbook was called Clark's column. And so recall that somebody could have proprioceptive loss without affecting cerebellar function, theoretically, or could have cerebellar loss of function on a proprioceptive basis and still have good proprioception if the dorsal column were spared. And you had the lateral Clark's column involved. Okay, so then the system rises all the way up. This is the posterior column medial lemniscal system. I won't spend any more time on that, but just the point is its first synapse is up in the brainstem. And here's a comparison of the two systems, the lateral brainstem and medial brainstem pathways. So the lateral brainstem pathways are primarily sensory, large fiber, and the, so here's the medial brainstem pathways and the lateral brainstem pathways, and the difference in how they ascend. There's a lot more synapses with the medial brainstem pathways than there are with the lateral brainstem pathways. Okay, and then I think I'm going to skip forward because I think people understand these connections fairly well. Just a word on the nerve fibers that we're talking about, and the fiber types 1A, 1B, which are the largest fiber types, go at about 100 meters per second. If you compute that out, that winds up being about 220 miles per hour. So it's like a Porsche on the Autobahn. And these C fibers and A delta fibers, which are the small fibers we're talking about, are anywhere from 0.5 to 30 meters per second, which are much smaller. This is walking speed. These are the various end organs are sensory end organs. We're focusing on these right here, C fibers, which mostly subserve pain and temperature. We're also focusing on the A delta fibers. Now, when you experience, let's say you stub your toe, and you remember saying to yourself, in about a quarter second, this is really going to hurt. So that means you actually had time to process the information, right? So the signal got to your brain, and you had time, about a quarter of a second, to say to yourself, this is going to hurt. Why is that? Well, because the original signal comes through a delta or sometimes even a beta fibers, depending on which system you're talking about. And so you get the initial pain signal, travels fairly rapidly, about 30 or 40 meters per second, and then the very deep tissue pain uses the C fibers to travel extremely slowly. So in general, when we talk about small fiber neuropathy, we're talking about either unmyelinated fibers, which are the C fibers, or very thinly myelinated fibers, which are the A delta fibers. And usually, these will spare the A beta fibers and the type 1A, type 1B fibers, which are subserving motor function. These are the ones over here that travel through that cerebellar pathway. So there is very little conscious proprioception of this information. This information is entirely used by the cerebellum to plan movement or to adjust movement. Okay, so here's a case I want to show you. This is a 50-year-old woman. She's got numb feet. And on the right, this is going on about 18 months. This is very typical. Very typical. It begins, often begins asymmetrically. Right's 18 months, left is 9 months. And she's had pain in her feet now for about 6 months, worse than standing, much better than being off her feet. And she's also got bilateral buttock pain, right greater than left. So do you see that with small fiber neuropathy? Can you? Okay, no back pain. No bowel, bladder, or orthostatic symptoms. So the question is whether this is compatible with small fiber neuropathy. So what do you think? Is that small fiber neuropathy?
Right. Take a scan. It has some atypical features because you have this right leg and
so some atypical, right. So some atypical features.
Almost like claudication.
Yeah. So what I want to use this case to talk about, this is a real case I saw. I want to use this case to talk about when you see distal pain, don't jump to the conclusion that it's necessarily small fiber neuropathy. And so it's got its own so here's an EMG. The only finding on EMG was an absent H reflex bilaterally. She's got a posterior disc osteophyte at L5S1, minimal L4-5 disc, fasting blood sugar 117, normal A1C, B12's fine, ANA is somewhat elevated, and her rheumatoid factor is elevated. So we're not all that much further in the diagnosis, right? Still have a reasonable differential. So what non-small fiber neuropathy diagnosis is presentation suggest? So you know, not everything that's distal pain is small fiber neuropathy. And what would you say is the actual presentation rate? How often do people present with this kind of a, so what do you think? We talked about question one already. What about question two? What do you think is this common? Let's just rank it against Parkinson's disease. More or less common than Parkinson's disease?
More,
yeah. I think far more common parts. Okay, so third question, if she's got a normal A1C, does that mean that, let's say, sugar dysmetabolism is excluded? I think people in this room are the converted, but we need to convert the endocrinologist. We know that's not the case, that this is an association. And so what additional evaluation? Okay. So I just put this slide up because this happens all the time. We, as neurologists, we sometimes get into this box, we sort of think about neuropathy. But you have to think about local process involving the feet, plantar fasciitis, rheumatoid arthritis, which ultimately turned out to probably be a component of her complaints. Vascular process, ischemia, venous dysfunction. And we see a lot of patients who have postural tachycardia syndrome, for example, who have distal pain. And I'm not sure that they have necessarily small fiber neuropathy pain. It may be that they're not getting blood back up to their heart, they're distending their venous system all the time, and that in and of itself is a painful process. But erythromelalgia is a very specific syndrome in which you have pain in the hands and feet that occurs at a specific colder temperature. And so warmer temperature. So people tend to keep their rooms at a very cold temperature. Sometimes they even put their feet in ice buckets and wind up with injuries that way, because every time the temperature rises above a certain point, they develop pain. And the gene and receptors actually been worked out for this. So then neurologic non-small fiber process, sometimes restless legs can be confused. So you can, somebody says they have pain, but you really get down to it, it's really discomfort. Tarsal tunnel syndrome, and then confluent S1, S2 radiculopathies, which in this case probably might have been playing a role here as well. So what is small fiber neuropathy? There's no consensus as opposed to some of the issues that we deal with, like orthostatic hypotension or even postural tachycardia syndrome, where there's a consensus definition. There's no consensus definition. So right now we're dealing with a conceptual framework, and what we understand when we say somebody's got small fiber neuropathy is that they have a disorder in which the small myelinated or unmyelinated fibers are involved more than the thickly myelinated fibers. So it's not saying the thickly myelinated fibers are not involved, but this is the predominant presentation. And so autonomic neuropathy, what's the difference between small fiber and autonomic? Autonomic would be a subset. Autonomic neuropathy means it's primarily an autonomic presentation. Small fiber neuropathy means you have both an autonomic presentation and you have loss of sensation or pain. So no consensus. So maybe we can think about involvement restricted to efferents or afferents, temperature, pain, visceral nerves only. Usually, we wouldn't accept a lot of reflex loss. We might say, okay, maybe they can have an ankle jerk being gone, or they might have some the strength in their toes. But if they have much more than that, then we say, no, this is a general neuropathy that includes small fiber involvement. And then I'll spend a fair amount of time on this simply because this becomes very confusing. We see a lot of patients who have not just distal issues, but some proximal issues, thoracic radiculopathies, abdominal pain. And so I think we need to think about this group of disorders as not just neuropathy, but radiculoneuropathy or radiculoganglioneuropathy, because you have involvement of the roots and the ganglia in many cases. So diabetes is a prime example in which it's not just the distal nerves that are involved, but you have patchy involvement proximally.
Did you cover what the autonomic nerves, do they fall within their classification of
Yes. So preganglionic, but I'll answer the question. Preganglionic autonomic nerves are A delta, and postganglionic autonomic nerves are C, primarily, in general. So they tend to be quite unmyelinated. Because if you think about it, you know, if you're living in sweat an hour and half a second, it doesn't matter. But whether you vasodilate or vasoconstrict. Okay, so this is my own attempt. I've read through the literature carefully to try to establish prevalence. And there's really nobody's gone out and done a study of 2,000 normal patients to see what the population prevalence is. But we can sort of make some, so Sjogren's disease, in 60% of patients with Sjogren's who had distal burning pain, so first of all, Sjogren's distal burning pain is very common. So about 60% of patients complain of that. And this group, and I'll show you some little data in just a second, 45% of this, they were convinced, had a small fiber neuropathy. Diabetes is very common. It's probably upwards of 60%. Now, it depends on whether you're going to use laboratory criteria or clinical criteria. Clinical criteria is not so common. You probably are close to 30% if you just, they have a complaint. But if you test them, about 60% will have loss of an axon reflex or two in the feet, or loss of small fiber sensation by quantitative sensory testing. So if we said, this is my inferred prevalence, if we said, okay, diabetes is approximately 60% of the population, that we know, distal burning pain occurs about 50% of the population, 3% of the population, then this is just diabetes. So maybe only one third are referred to neurology clinic, because primary physicians often don't know what to do with this, they don't refer it, they just say, well, just it's your diabetes, ignore it. So if we assume that one in three have diabetes, who are referred for small fiber neuropathy, that's about right. I would say one in three, you know, I see with small fiber neuropathy have diabetes, at least, maybe more. So diabetes is pre-diabetes. Diabetes and pre-diabetes. That means two in three patients that we see have some other function. Or maybe say half. So just So three times, prevalence would be maybe 9%. So if we say, okay, this is too high an estimate, you know, so if you've overestimated, we'll cut that in half. So let's say 3 to 5% of the population may have either an autonomic or distal burning pain syndrome, which is a pretty high number. It actually might be worth doing a study to figure out, you know, what actually is this prevalence. Now, there's one Italian study in 1995 where they found prevalence of 3%. They actually did a random population survey and found a 3% prevalence. So that's the only thing I could find. Parkinson's is 1%. So, yeah, everybody in this room is correct. It's probably about 3 times the rate of Parkinson's disease, which is a pretty good number. So, do you agree with that from your clinical experience? Does that seem about right?
Yeah.
Okay. Stay up arguing.
I don't agree.
Right?
I mean, you talk about how you define Parkinson's. I mean,
clinical Parkinson's, yeah.
Diagnosed Parkinson's, yeah. Patients who have symptoms that might be Parkinson's, or...
That's a good question, but I'm just saying 1% of the population is Parkinson's based on epidemiological study. Okay, and so now the other thing that's important to know about this is if the small fiber neuropathy is in the context of a disease like Sjogren's or a disease like diabetes, the prognosis for that disorder is very poor. So it's important to know, it's not just sort of a random fact, but it's important to know who's actually got small fiber neuropathy and who doesn't. So between 1980 and 1983, 23% to 56% mortality, 5 different studies at 5 years. So this is not small potatoes. This is very, very bad. So why is that? Nobody knows.
Mortality is not from neuropathy.
No, it's not from neuropathy, but it's associated with it. And it's not from kidney disease, not from heart disease, and so on and so forth. This is independent of those factors. Yeah. It's very bad. But there's a lot of studies that have looked at things like QT interval changes. The current thinking is that you have islands. A lot of these are sudden cardiac deaths. And the current thing is you have islands of innervation and denervation in the heart so that you can easily get a re-entry. And of course, everyone's got a little vascular disease because they have diabetes, cardiovascular disease. So you get a little area that's ischemic and you form, you have this big sympathetic discharge in the area that's ischemic. The neighboring area doesn't have any sympathetic, so it can't go at the same time. So you wind up with a re-entrance arrhythmia and you go into ventricular tachycardia. So that's the thinking, but it's not been proven.
This is diabetics.
This is diabetics.
Diabetics,
yeah.
Not all small fiber.
No, I'm sorry. I realize my slide is confusing because it doesn't say diabetics. These are diabetic, 5 studies, only diabetics.
If you have it, you have it.
You have diabetes, your risk is very poor.
Okay.
So, conceptual approach to small fiber neuropathy, at least how I approach it right now is I try to figure out which, first of all, document that you really have it. So I will, most of the time I'll do an EMG, unless the patient has normal reflexes and no complaints at all, I might not. But most of the time I'll get an EMG. Quantitative sensory testing to vibration to assess the large somatic fibers. And then I'll assess the small somatic fibers using quantitative sensory testing to heat and to pain. And recently we've been cold as well, because cold seems to be different than heat, and there's not a lot of data on this. And I want to know, are these pretty much the same? This is read out, this quantitative sensory testing is read out in percentiles, so you know how much of the population is worse than this person. So if they're normal, they're going to be up to maybe the 70th percentile. Once you get into the 80th and 90th percentile, they get to be abnormal. A lot of these patients will be 60th, 70th percentile vibration, so you know, not perfect, but still within the range of normal. And 99th percentile here. So you know there's a big difference between what's the small fiber sensory involvement and a large fiber sensory involvement. Small autonomic fibers, we check using autonomic testing. And then if you want to look at the combination, you can use skin biopsy. And Dan, you've had the most experience of anybody with skin biopsy. How have you?
It seems to, when it's something where it's kind of the last thing you're doing for somebody that you don't really think has it, those are much more apt to come normal. Like it fits clinically, I think, with the clinical suspicion. I probably got a dozen or so.
Yeah, unfortunately, these tests don't correlate. It's not like, you know, EMG, where you have this clear correlation, say, between the sural is gone and you have distal changes. And I think some of the problem here is this ganglionopathy business, and I'm going to come to that. The fact that you have some cases where you have a radicular pattern, not a
And I think that's where the why this.
By the way, that's Dr. Zhang from the clinic is going to tell us about this thing about the next month.
Oh, perfect. Great.
Next month. Or
well, this is one of her slides.
I'm going to ask, so yeah.
Okay.
So then, those labs that you're doing now, on a clinical basis, the patient showed normal EMG, normal
resource,
energy is the last resort?
That's the majority of the referrals, yeah.
It's like the same kind of patient with the historical neuropathy, and then it's everything normal.
Yeah.
And they get dizzy, and the signaling is on this.
Okay. So here's the issue. This is the problem we have with fibromyalgia. Concordance, total patients with, so this is a study done by Hawkins, Snyder, Smith, and others. And what they did was they looked at concordance of different types of findings in patients whom they thought had small fibromyalgia. Now, remember, with small fibromyalgia, there's no gold standard. It's a clinical diagnosis. So, you know, I could go there and argue and say, no, this person really doesn't have small fibromyalgia, and argue with who they included. So that's why this is a difficult area. So they had 74 patients, and they diagnosed by fairly good clinical criteria, 37 of them. So half of them, they said, had small fiber neuropathy. And
this was published in Brain, wasn't it? Oh, yeah.
So abnormal axon reflex was 42%. Actually, is this obvious? It's at the bottom of my slide. I've got it.
The Brain one was 2008, I thought.
Oh, yeah, this is our
kind. A new one from 2007 or 8 from Brain. Okay.
Anyway, they found abnormal cerebral axon reflex in 42%, which is about right. Abnormal quantitative sensory test in 51%. But the concordance is not so good. You've only got 16%. And you'd like to see both. You'd like to know that you've got two tests. A little bit like carpal tunnel, you'd like to know that you've got two tests documenting this. Often you only have one, so you have to say, okay, I've got a clinical picture, I've got one test, am I going to say this is what it is? But so the issue is, are we dealing with different small fiber subsets? And are we dealing with a multitude of different disorders, or sort of grouping into this category of small fiber neuropathy? And that's why we have such a poor concordance. And I think this is everyone's experience. So, we've got no gold standard right now. We've got to deal with what we have. So I think most of us use clinical criteria. I think an empiric approach at this point, until we have a better consensus definition, is what you have to use. And I think it'd be nice to have a careful clinical characterization of patients who present with both. So when people have distal pain, how many of those have autonomic problems? People have autonomic problems, how many of those have distal pain? So we know really, in an epidemiologic sense, what the overlap is. So we've developed this questionnaire, which is called the SPIBS questionnaire, which Amer and Bash and I utilize, and Kamal at the Cleveland Clinic. And it basically asks a bunch of questions to the patient that are face valid, and we try to figure out if they have large fiber sensory loss, and we're screening everybody with this to try to get a sense of who's got who presenting with an autonomic picture actually has sensory loss, and who presenting with sensory picture actually has autonomic loss, and how much large fiber we have. I've got some data from that, but I'm not showing that today. Okay, so this person's autonomic testing, the one case I presented, got a normal cardiac response to deep breathing, normal Valsalva ratio, mild increase in heart rate from 85 to 110 without any drop in blood pressure, and normal axon reflexes. So it doesn't seem like a small fiber neuropathy based on this. Okay, so 3-hour glucose tolerance test. She does wind up rising to 220, coming back down at 214, and 3 hours 116. So we ultimately wound up saying this person, we diagnosed glucose intolerance in somebody who doesn't have a small fiber. So undiagnosed dysmetabolism of sugar, that's the same paper, and they looked at the dysmetabolism of sugar in patients with small fiber neuropathy. They found that the majority of their patients had
presenting a small fiber neuropathy has some abnormality of sugar metabolism, and actually a full quarter had undiagnosed frank diabetes. So I think that's bigger than the YSD. I don't diagnose a quarter of my patients with small fiber neuropathy with diabetes, but certainly 1 in 10. So every time, and the bottom line is, every time you see somebody with an undiagnosed autonomic neuropathy, get a 3-hour glucose tolerance test. Because you may diagnose impaired fasting sugar, which is important as far as managing your diet, increasing their fiber, and so on and so forth, or you may need to diagnose diabetes, which is a very, that may be the first presentation of diabetes. Okay, now, the question is, why would this be? I mean, our concept has always been that you get diabetes. I mean, 20 years ago when I was doing my residency, the general concept was, you get diabetes, then you have over 5 or 10 years all of the metabolic changes, ischemic changes, and eventually you get neuropathy. So why would we be going the other way and seeing that we see people with neuropathy and then we diagnose diabetes? That doesn't seem to make sense according to that concept. So this is a very interesting set of studies that was done by a group in Canada. And basically, their setup is they have these mice that develop type 1 diabetes. That's their setup. And they look to see how that happens. So type 1 diabetes, in general, is tends to be an immune-mediated process where you have antibodies that bind to the beta cells in the pancreas. And lo and behold, they found that these mice always develop antibodies to Schwann cells before they develop antibodies to the islet cells. So they said to themselves, well, maybe it's a coincidence, maybe this is pathogenic. What if we blocked the development of the antibody to the Schwann cells without altering the possibility of developing the antibody to islet cells? So they got specific anti-Schwann cell antibodies, you know, antibodies to the antibodies, to try to neutralize the Schwann cell antibodies to see if they will still get the islet cell antibodies. Meaning, you actually have to break through. Now, one other fact I should tell you is, this was not known to me until I read this paper, but in the pancreas, there are small fibers that innervate every little islet, and the Schwann cell actually surrounds the islet cell. So the question is, is this protective? Is this Schwann cell protective of the islet cell? And this, here's the innervation cone that comes in. So the answer is yes. The answer is, if you block the formation of Schwann cells, antibodies, you block the occurrence of diabetes in these mice. So this illustrates this. So this is sort of a three-stain preparation. The blue shows the islets on the inside. So they don't have the blue here because it'd be confusing. But the blue would be in here. Okay? And the red are antibodies to Schwann cells. And the green are the T cells. And the T cells are attacking the Schwann cells first, long before they attack the islet cells. And if you block this, then you don't get diabetes in these mice. You say, okay, well, that's a mouse model. What does that have to do with humans? And it turns out that in about 60% of type 1 diabetics, you see antibodies to Schwann cells. GFAP antibodies are present. So I called this guy and said, look, this is interesting. As a neurologist, I all the time see these patients who develop small fiber neuropathy first, and then they get diabetes. But these are mostly type 2s. What if I sent you some serum, and you look to see if there's a GFAP antibody? He said, sure, let's do it. So he got an IRB through, and and send them some serum. So far we've done 2 patients because it's been very difficult. I called them, I think it's about 2 years ago. We've been able to get 2 patients in him who had this picture, and both of them were very positive for GFAP antibody. It's not published yet, so don't let it go out. It's something that's pretty easy to do. But anyway, so it turns out that, so my thinking right now, I think you're probably wrong, my thinking right now, the reason patients gets neuropathy before diabetes is actually the neuropathy is part of causing the diabetes. That's a part, so it's in reverse. It's not that the diabetes causes neuropathy, but in these cases where it's early, the neuropathy is actually in some way enabling the diabetes, or at least there are co-occurrences of an immune process affecting both Schwann cells and islet cells. So that's my sort of my take on why this happens early. So did this patient have a small fiber neuropathy or not? I still can't answer that question. I think that's kind of my point in this patient, this first patient. They often have patients who just can't answer the question. Does it really alter your management that much? No, not that much. You check to make sure they don't have diabetes. If you do, if they do, you treat it. Then I set her for some water jogging and some physical therapy. Instructed her weight reduction and improved her diabetes and put her in on some topiramate, and she got markedly better. She improved. I still can't tell you what the diagnosis was. And what does this tell us about symptom mechanism? Well, she had a neuropathic symptom mechanism. That doesn't mean she had a small fiber neuropathy. Okay, now I want to talk about, well, why do people with small fiber neuropathy develop pain? You think, okay, small fiber neuropathy, you should be getting rid of the nerve fibers, right? So you should be having a reduction in function, not an increase in function. It turns out that there are four changes that occur in the nerves that are in nerves that are injured. And the first thing that happens is, so this is, again, a mouse model, actually it's a rat model. And what they did was they did an exotomy. And this is the control group, and this is the exotomy group. And they looked at the expression of various types of sodium channels. And so, of course, the sodium channel is a critical portion of the action potential. And there's the standard, sort of the most common, so-called alpha-3 sodium channel is normally normally not expressed. And so in the control, you have very little of this. And in the exotomized animal, this particular sodium channel, I'm going to show you the characteristics of the sodium channel in just a second, this sodium channel becomes highly expressed. Now, the standard sodium channels, which are the alpha SNS and the alpha NAN, these sodium channels are normally expressed. If you look in the post-exotomy, they become unexpressed. So now, potentially, the action potential is going to change. So if you look at the sodium channel, what you find is that it has a very rapid recovery time and can fire repeatedly. So it's able to fire at rates upwards of 70, 80, 90 hertz. So now one of the safeguards, of course, is the refractory period of the sodium channel that doesn't prevent a nerve from firing repeatedly. But what happens here is with this channel, you find the recovery time is markedly reduced. So here's the recovery time of the abnormal and the recovery time of the control. So that's one thing. The sodium channels are different. They can fire fast. But you've got a lot of other safeguards, right, in the nerve. So you've got hyperpolarizing currents that prevent the nerve from firing over and over, fluoride currents, calcium channel currents. Turns out those are damaged too. So in the damaged nerve, you lose fluoride channels, you lose calcium channels, and so this hyperpolarizing current that's supposed to prevent the nerve from firing again and again is gone. So now you've got a nerve that not only has a sodium channel that allows it to fire continuously without much stimulus and reverberates, but now there's no damping on it. So it can fire at will without any damping. Okay, that's number two. Number three. Effective transmission, the transmission across nerves. So if you ever thought about this, what prevents, I want this finger to sweat, or at least my stomach area. And why would a pain fiber that's sitting right along that nerve not fire also? So remember, in the myelinated system, you've got a lot of myelin between, so it's very unlikely for one large fiber to trigger another large fiber. But in an unmyelinated system, remember, they're all sitting together in the Schwann cell with very little barrier between each nerve. So how come they don't crossfire in a normal situation? Well, this is back in 76, but Aguirre did this painstaking study where he actually sliced through the nerves at 100 micron intervals. Because his hypothesis was, if these things are not cross-fired, they must be repositioned. In other words, it takes about 250, if I have two nerves next to each other without any myelin between, about 250 microns, about a quarter millimeter, one's going to trigger the other. They're going to fire.
So he was saying there's no other protection. These things must be repositioning so that they're never in contact for 250 microns with one another. In other words, they're braided. That's what he's saying, they're braided. And that's what he found. The fascicles are braided. If you follow any one particular, so this is a picture of inside the Schwann cell, a bunch of small fiber axons. And for example, this one here should be able to crossfire that one there. But if you look a little bit further down, he labeled these, and that's not shown on the figure, he labeled them to be able to follow particular ones. He found that it was repositioned in a completely different portion of the fascicle. So they're braided. But when the nerve is injured and recovers, it doesn't bother to braid like that. So in the injured axon, now you've got the possibility of effective transmission, which is transmission from one nerve to another across the axon. So when I want my finger to sweat, guess what? I could also be triggering pain from that finger. That's number three. Number four is the axotomy that occurs. And so if you do an axotomy, there's a sympathetic crosstalk. Let me see if I can tell you. Okay. So if you axotomize, normally you have no connection between the small fiber neuropathy, the small nerves, the dorsal ganglion cells, and the sympathetic cells. So they're completely unrelated. The only sympathetics that run through a dorsal ganglion are sympathetics that might go to blood vessels, and they should go to all blood vessels. But after axotomy, what happens is, so this is a picture of a dorsal ganglion, and what the stain, this is David Katz at the medical school, he's done a stain for tyrosine hydroxylase, which is a stain for sympathetic terminals. So you can see normally you don't have any sympathetic terminals here, except right here, maybe around a vessel, and maybe over here. Now, here after the axotomy, you see that the sympathetics are synapsing on the dorsal ganglion cells. So you now have a connection where you never had one before. And why does this happen? It turns out, this is a sort of long story, but it turns out nerve growth factor is the trigger. So when you have a nerve injury, the dorsal ganglion produces nerve growth factor in order to help itself grow back. But as part of this process, it now attracts these sympathetic neurons. So sympathetic neurons are synapsing on top of the dorsal ganglion cells. So now here's another connection. So before I said, well, when this finger sweats, it might have pain because I have that connection between the two nerves out here. Now I've got a connection up here. When the finger sweats, I stimulate my sympathetics. Guess what? The sympathetic might be going to sweat gland down here, but right up here it's going to a sensory neuron. So it can stimulate the sensory neuron. So you now have a connection that should never have been there before.
So is this probably central sensation?
No, because this is happening in the dorsal ganglion. So it's happening in the periphery. Central sensitization refers to changes, and I'll cover that in just a second, changes that occur in the dorsal horn and the thalamus as a result of this. But this is actually in the periphery. It's actually very proximal in the periphery. But it's in the periphery. Okay, next case. This is just to kind of talk about tests. So this is a 60-year-old right-handed guy. Last 15 to 18 months, ball of feet felt swollen, pain in the knees, elbows, shoulders, dry eyes, dry mouth, and recent onset of erectile dysfunction. No urinary problems, no sweating problems, no dizziness, swallowing. So then he says, yeah, I do have some burning in my feet, but that's not a chief complaint. And it's worse at night. Okay, so he's got some orthostatic hypotension, just borderline, and he's got a non-length dependent small fiber neuropathy. So let's just kind of go over some of his tests. And I want to use this as a sort of springboard to talk about the tests and how they're used. Okay, so his EMG is normal. QSARC shows mildly reduced output in the forearm, proximal leg and calf, but not in the foot. And how many have seen that? It's a frustrating thing. How many have set for automatic testing and you find, you know, you'd like to see the foot's gone, the calf's reduced, the hands, you know, maybe a little bit reduced, and the forearm's fine. But we don't see that. We see the opposite a lot. Deep breathing response is abnormal,
So he's got parasympathetic cardiac dysfunction. Valsalva ratio is reduced. And it actually, on his tilt table, has moderately severe orthostatic hypotension, which we really wouldn't have guessed, because he's got no test speed would guess this, or nobody else would. He's got no dizziness, and his bedside testing doesn't show much. Okay, so again, we find a abnormal glucose at zero, fasting sugar is abnormal, and he's got an abnormal M protein is negative in serum and urine. Okay. So, what does autonomic testing add, and why should you do it? Why should you bother with it? The first thing it does is it tells you, is there autonomic fiber involvement or not? At least it's best tested by what we do, which is mostly cardiovascular sweat testing. We don't check the bladder, we don't check the bowel, so we don't know that somebody couldn't have a focal involvement of those nerve fibers. So we just need a screen. What is abnormal? You can tell generally whether it tends to be a central nervous system or peripheral nervous system. And again, I want to emphasize this prognosis in diabetes can be very, very serious. Just want to cover this, which is, so where does small fiber neuropathy fit in the spectrum of autonomic disorders? You've got, you know, all these autonomic disorders, you've got postural tachycardia syndrome, orthostatic hypotension. So where does small fiber neuropathy fit? I tend to think of autonomic disorders as having two major categories, disease-based and syndromic. By disease-based, I mean there's a disease causing autonomic nervous system dysfunction, like diabetes, multiple system atrophy, myelopathy, and syndromic is secondary. So you've got postural tachycardia syndrome, passing out, fibromyalgia. We don't really know what the autonomic nervous system is doing in any of these. We just know that autonomic neurologists wind up seeing something. That's about it. So it's defined by who's seeing them, not so much what the pathophysiology is. So then, in disease-based, you can divide things into peripheral and central. So in the peripheral nervous system, in the central nervous system, you've got multiple system atrophy, and you've got a bunch of other things I didn't put up here, but strokes, myelopathy. Peripheral nervous system, you have pure autonomic failure, which is really sort of the ALS of autonomic failure. Degeneration at, but it's not central, it's degeneration at the ganglion level. And then you've got this category of small fiber neuropathy that we're talking about today. And you can divide that into a set of causes, diabetes, immune-mediated, genetic, metabolic, mitochondrial, inflammatory. Those are the major players in small fiber neuropathy. So basically, when you do autonomic testing, you're answering a bunch of questions. You're trying to figure out where the lesion is. You're trying to figure out, is this pandas autonomia, all branches are affected, or just some? And then you figure out what you need to do. So this guy, as I'll come to in a little bit, had unsuspected orthostatic hypotension that was quite severe. So what are we going to do about that? Okay. Now, most of this audience knows this well. I'm just going to cover this very quickly. But when you try to distinguish central nervous system from peripheral nervous system disorders, you divide out. You use the test of sweating, you divide it out. Our point is a little bit different than everybody else's. We use the ganglion as a point because it's easy. So post-ganglionic lesions are peripheral. Pre-ganglionic lesions we tend to consider central, but that does get us into a little trouble in some cases because if you think about it, somebody could have a normal axon reflex and could have something like diabetes if it's affecting that little teeny half-inch segments between the spinal canal and the ganglion. So you have to think about that as well. But basically, if the axon reflex is normal, then we think they have a central nervous system problem. And if the axon reflex is abnormal, we think they have a peripheral nervous system problem. And we use the thermoregulatory sweat test to confirm or to balance the findings. In general, you'll have a distal to proximal gradient in the thermoregulatory sweat test finding in peripherally, and central nervous system will give you an inverted pattern when you have preservation in the feet and hands. This is the axon reflex. I'm not going to cover that today. And this is the sweat test. it shows a distal, in a small fiber neuropathy, it'll show a distal gradient. Okay, cardiac response to breathing, it checks parasympathetics. I'm not going to cover that more today. The Valsalva maneuver checks the whole system. Checks cardiac sympathetic, cardiac parasympathetic, and vasomotor sympathetic. And actually, I will do this. Have everybody please put your hand, put your pulse on your hand. I use pulse on your hand. Put your hand, put your fingers on your pulse. Okay? And on a count of three, I'm going to ask you to take a large, deep breath. It's going to last 5 seconds. Okay? Ready? One, two, three. Okay, hold it up there. Okay, now breathe out. Okay, what do you observe? What do you observe? If anything? What?
Pulse went down.
Went down, so go down
with the
expiration. So on inspiration, unless you're nervous, on inspiration, you have a cardio acceleration. On expiration, you have a cardio deceleration. And the idea, basically, physiologically, is you fill your lungs with air, you also want to fill your lungs with blood. So a little bit of cardio acceleration just helps pump a little bit of additional blood into your lung. The blood capacity of the lung is only 100 cc's with exhalation, about 500 cc's with inhalation. So that little just gives a little kick, and that is entirely needed by a reflex through the autonomic pathways. Okay, so then I want to talk a little bit about what we see on tilt table tests. So we covered just briefly Valsalva maneuver. And what do we see on tilt table tests? Well, there's three basic patterns on tilt table tests. Pattern number one is the one we saw in this person, which is a gradual sustained drop in blood pressure, systolic 20 or diastolic 10, and it has to be in the first 3 minutes, and it has to be sustained. So this red line is heart rate, this blue line is blood pressure, so that's this pattern. You see a drop in blood pressure, and you may or may not see compensatory increase in heart rate. Postural tachycardia syndrome is different. You see there an increase in heart rate, but blood pressure does not change at all. And with syncope, you see a sudden drop in blood pressure and heart rate with sometimes a little bit of cardiac acceleration beforehand. So the physiology of these three is very different, and the implication of these three is very different. So when you see orthostatic hypotension, the main issue is an arterial system issue, which is a diastolic problem. You're losing the ability to constrict your arterial vessels. You contrast that with postural tachycardia, you often get a narrow pulse pressure because systole can't be maintained, but mean pressure stays just fine. They're not perfusing very well because not very much blood is coursing, and that's why they get this tachycardia. So they're pumping to try to get blood through, but they don't drop their blood pressure. And then syncope is fainting, and this is a threshold, brainstem threshold issue. What happens is everybody can faint. I can make every human being on this planet faint. This is a normal reflex. So it's just a question of whether you faint in the appropriate circumstance or inappropriate circumstance. It defines whether you have syncope or not. So the implications are very different. So the implications of orthostatic hypotension, remember that what we divided, that divide between two types of dysautonomia, the disease-based and syndromic. So it turns out that these tend to be syndromic. And this is seen in disease-based. So when I see somebody with orthostatic hypotension, my own feeling about it is the prognosis is not going to be that good. It's seen in bad diabetes, it's seen in multiple system atrophy. And it's a small fiber neuropathy, it will tend to be a severe diffuse type. Postural tachycardia, on the other hand, tends to be syndromic. If it's associated with a small fiber neuropathy, it tends to be mild, focal, and I can tell the patient your prognosis is going to be probably very good. And reflex syncope is usually not associated with any small fiber neuropathy, unless it's in the context of one of these two. Okay, so this is this person's tilt study. See, they started about 100 or 120 over 80, and early, just like we saw in the exam, they didn't have much. Then they get down here, starts dropping, and gets down to about 40, and says, I'm a little tired, can you tilt me back? That's what he had symptoms. And so then we tilt him back. Okay, I'm going to skip pupillometry because we don't do it. But be aware that it's probably an up-and-coming method. Probably in about 3 or 4 years we'll have a better understanding of what pupillometry can tell us. So this particular person, what do you think they had? Let me go back. So what do you think this person had? So they have very bad episodic hypertension. They have not much in the way of large fiber changes. And they have a fairly bad autonomic neuropathy. So what do you think is the cause there? So what would be any differential diagnosis? Yes, diabetes, right? So we stop there. So we could stop there. And maybe people might say, okay, that's a good point. But he went on to biopsy, and it turns out he had amyloidosis. And so what? So he had skin biopsy, which I think I have next. Sorry, this is out of order. This is skin biopsy. No nerves. This is like no nerves, basically. And here, basically, no nerves. This is what it should. This is not their control. This is Bill Kennedy's control, but it would not be green. It would look like this. So normally, you see these fibers throughout the dermis, and they pop into the epidermis. Remember, when we're doing a skin biopsy, we're only doing the epidermis. We're not actually looking at the dermis. Bill Kennedy does look at the dermis, which is a much finer way of looking at the nerves. You get much more information because you can divide, are they sweat nerves? Are they... But when you look at the epidermis, you only see sensory nerves. Anyway, so he had amyloidosis, and that brings up an important point. In what percentage of people with known diabetes with workup show that they actually have something else contributing to their disorder? That was a paper probably about 8 years. So it turns out that number is somewhere around 25 to 30%, and that includes B12 deficiency, B6 deficiency, B6 excess, a paraprotein, so on. Okay. So I just want to move forward. Skin biopsy does correlate with exam pretty well. Okay, the QSAR is not, as I said before, doesn't correlate that well. So you have these two tests, they don't correlate that well. So Congo red, positive fibrils.
Is ACE elevated in the
gut? Sorry?
Is ACE elevated in the
gut? ACE? Is it elevated in amyloid? You think it's sarcoid? No.
Oh,
yeah. No, he didn't have an M protein. So we just done urine or blood, we wouldn't have detected it. So you have to do skin biopsy.
The amyloid was on the skin biopsy.
Yeah, amyloid was on skin biopsy. So I'm going to skip forward through. I think what I would like to, I think what would be most interesting would be, let me cover treatment, the management of small fiber neuropathy pain, and let me cover the, this time I'll cover it. Okay, so this is just making the point again that you got to get a glucose tolerance test. You can't just get an A1C or a fasting sugar. So you think about diabetic neuropathies, there are many types. We're talking about a fairly, what we see in our practice often are early in diabetes, and sometimes they're associated with weight loss and associated with a change in insulin usage, which is sort of, I sort of think of this as a triad. But these are focal and multifocal neuropathies that may occur fairly abruptly, and so most likely have an ischemic rather than a metabolic basis. Okay, so this association we covered with, B12 traditionally is considered to be a large fiber process. It's no longer considered a large fiber process. And the key with B12, if you identify it in somebody with a small fiber neuropathy, you have to replace them with way more than usual. You got to replace them about 4,000 micrograms per month compared to the usual being 1,000 micrograms. And that was a paper out of Kentucky that is instead of four patients who did not improve on 1,000 and improved on 4,000. So I don't know if that's true or not, but since B12 isn't harmful, that's what I do. Okay, then there's a fair number of toxin. Metronidazole is the one you want to keep in mind. as the main cause of, and that's, you see that a lot, flagellate as a cause of autonomic neuropathy. Okay, we talked about Sjogren's, other vascular disease, and it's a very common disorder. Let me get to, and I just say a word about hereditary causes. Riley Day, which is familiar to dysautonomia, you probably will see very, very rarely, actually probably two or three cases being a specialist in it, because they all go to Felicia Axelrod in New York. But it's classified as HSAN type 3. It's easy to remember because the HSANs, the odd ones are the ones that have small fiber. So 1, 3, and 5 have more small fiber. And this is due to a mutation of a gene, IKB-CAP gene, on chromosome 9. And it's not clear exactly what that gene does, but it's a controller gene. It controls the expression of other genes. Okay, and I won't mention Fabry's or porphyria because these are other disorders that are fairly rare, but you should think about them as the potential cause of small fiber neuropathy. Porphyria is very difficult to diagnose because you may only see abnormal metabolites with a crisis. And I have one patient I've been following for 2 years now who's had two crises, and both times they blew, even though I wrote in like a big sheet what they should do in the emergency room, what kind of tubes, and so on and so forth, and how they should draw it. All three times we missed that time when we wanted to get the... And what you want to do is you want to get a PBG and delta ALA in the blood, and those should be elevated. Or you can get a... you can just go directly and measure the enzyme, and or measure the DNA, the gene. The problem is if the enzyme is functionally abnormal, then you will not see the abnormality. That's what we think we have with her. And so most of the time, this is going to be AIP, acute intermittent porphyria. But the corporal porphyrias and some of the others can also produce this. Okay, let me just skip this. This is really, it was a case of CRPS, and what I want to do is I want to go to I obviously tried to cover too much here. I want to talk about the management of neuropathic pain. So, so when you're managing pain, I think one of the key things we try to do is to relieve pain. And yes, that's part of it. But if that's the only thing you try to do in general with a chronic pain syndrome, you're not going to get very far. So the critical thing is to think about this as a process that has multiple comorbidities, and to make sure you're addressing all the comorbidities. Because some of the comorbidities, the patient won't necessarily tell you about. They won't necessarily tell you, I'm not sleeping at night. They assume you know that. They won't tell you, I'm feeling depressed or I'm not performing my job, because they figure, well, that's not really part of the complaint. They're just going to give you the somatic complaint of pain. So it's very important to take the time to elicit how they're functioning, what are they doing, how do they sleep. And pain itself is a little bit more difficult to manage in some cases than, for example, a secondary depression, secondary sleeplessness, or some of these other issues, which can be very difficult. Okay, so I always employ a function-oriented approach, which is, and this is especially somebody who's been to many doctors, has tried, you know, they've already been on Lyrica, Tolvaptan. Most of the time, interestingly, they haven't been on Eleva, so which is a great drug. I think most of the faculty here use it, but many, many neurologists, they don't use tricyclic, doesn't enter their mind and these are great drugs. But you want a function-oriented approach, which means, yeah, I'm going to help you help yourself. I'm not going to give you a drug that's going to melt your pain away. I'm not going to give you a cure. I'm going to help you help yourself. And so you want the person to go to rehab and then start an exercise program, and that is going to help them at least as much, if not more, than any drug you prescribe. Cognitive behavior therapy, in the tough cases, I'll send them to a psychologist who works with them in terms of how they're functioning. I use either Jeff Janata or Jennifer Levin here, but people in other systems I use as well. And I ask them to get a center membership. I ask them to really take the bull by the horns and get on. The idea is we're going to get on with your life. And we're going to try to relieve pain a little bit as part of this, but this is a life-changing experience that we need at this point. So that's why you need the behaviors.
Is there a grant that you get these people to be able to have the behavioral therapy?
No. No, insurance will pay for it. Insurance will pay for it. I had a grant for primary care physicians for a while. That's expired now.
And it turns out that even with that, it's difficult to get them in because travel issues and so on. So it's much better if it's local. It can be, you know, wherever they live, like in Sandusky, that's where they're going to get the problem over here. But you have to figure out, is this person pain informed or not? Because they can counsel on some kind of crazy things too. No, stop. You've got severe pain, stop doing everything. It's exactly the opposite of what you Now, if you are, you know, if you're using medication, which we tend to use, I tend to classify the symptom by what the mechanism is. So if they have burning pain, that's often going to be either peripheral sensitization or dorsal horn reorganization, and that's very sensitive to tricyclics. And remember, you don't have to only use a tricyclic at night. Amitriptyline, which is sort of the most commonly used, yes, you got to use that at night. But in imipramine, people tolerate during the day just fine. So if you really need daytime relief from burning pain, you can use imipramine. AE pain implies activation of signal receptors, so you can add something like Celebrex or something like this. Shooting pain implies a factor transmission. So that's in that case, I'll use an anticonvulsant. And in very rare cases, when it's really refractory and I really want something, I'll use oral lidocaine, which is called mexiltine. And that can be very, very effective where the other anticonvulsants have failed. You need an EKG before you do it. And I sometimes will send a patient to a cardiologist if they're older, just to make sure I'm not missing something. If they have allodynia, which is part of spontaneous pain and pain from a non-noxious stimulus, if that's to temperature, that's peripheral. If that's to mechanical, that's central. So I will tend to use creams. And don't forget we have pharmacies, we have several compounding pharmacies around here. We still use one of them. And they make these creams that can be very helpful. I like the clonidine creams, the ketamine clonidine cream. You've got peripheral receptors to this. You can use capsaicin, which is available in multiple formulations, or lidocaine cream. And a clonidine patch can sometimes make the difference between night and day if you've got a specific tonel sign, which I put right here. Sympathetically maintained components, steroids or alpha adrenergic blockers are good. And if you have paresthesia, then I use, I interpret paresthesia to be the same as shooting pain. So the common theme is non-pharmacologic strategies come first. They are going to achieve more for them. You have to convince the patients because they're coming from the same Western medical training that we're coming from. You know, our training is make a diagnosis, give a medication for the diagnosis. That's where they're coming from too. So the things you got to fight are deconditioning, depression, loss of self-esteem, anxiety issues. So these are some of the issues you have to work with. Okay, I don't have time to cover orthostatic hypertension, but I can cover that at some point in the future. All right, thanks.
There was an article in the New England Journal about a month ago about diabetics who have had type 2 diabetes long-standing, whether or not intensive blood sugar control involves various complications of diabetes and neuropathy. It was one of those which it did not.
Yeah.
They did get the A1C down, but they didn't affect neuropathy. Is there any, or are there any data to say that if you catch somebody early in diabetes, changing the blood sugar would affect a neuropathy in the future?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
It's a great question. Well, BCCP.
BCCP was put there back in the 90s.
Yeah.
They had primary prevention and secondary prevention. What do they call it? But the primary prevention, he has no neuropathy. Or nephropathy or retinopathy. It's all type 1 diabetes.
Okay.
Not type 2.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then they had secondary. So they both actually improved. So it's a clear difference if you go into blood sugar control.
Yeah.
Type 2 is not a lot of, there's a British study on type 2, I think, showing that maybe 3. I don't know that paper, the recent paper?
It's last month, yeah.
Oh.
So that's secondary, primary prevention, secondary, what's the secondary?
Primary prevention, you have no neuropathy
or
nothing. Secondary, if you have symptoms,
right.
And then you go on control.
Yeah,
that's
well, isn't there a word after secondary,
management
of people?
Prevention, secondary prevention.
Well,
I guess prevention of worsening. So they had a picture of the retinas and followed them over 10 years.
Yeah.
Because I think the issue is you get an abnormal glucose tolerance test, and then you have an answer. But
right.
What do you do about it?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I tend to put them on diet and weight loss, and if it's just that little, you know, I do treat it. And my own feeling is, well, it may or may not have dropped you, it shouldn't have already known.
Yeah. Is that technical question? Let's say that this is going to be a third hour.
I do the third hour because I'm interested in I personally am interested in hypoglycemia.
So you're looking for the...
Because I think that's early. So I think somebody who's got early glucose intolerance will actually get a hypoglycemic response in the third hour. Yeah.
The criteria is on the 2 hours.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Second hour. So.
Yeah, you could do 2 hours.
I mean, the problem with these patients also, when you make the diagnosis and then they say, okay, you have that, and they go to their doctor, and by the time they see their doctor, they've lost 5-10 pounds, it repeats as normal.
Yeah, right.
And say, oh, your lab's wrong.
Yeah, right.
And then we get in this argument, is it because they lost weight or they're watching now?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. I say, well, I'm checking my blood sugar, it never was about 100, but same time they're watching, they're not really eating sugar, they're not eating.
Yeah.
So you get into this debate, do you, don't you? And you say, you have it about 220 already, but now I'm not confirming it.
Yeah.
So it must be your lab is wrong.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
The other thing, cardiologists and I mean, I think we're behind the curve. They have a problem in dietary and lipid profile. And so they get patients sent to them if it's going to change in lipids. But if those guys go up, LDL goes up, HDL goes down, they'll have these patients and say to me, they're going to develop glucose intolerance in another year or two. He was always right. And so they think the lipid profile actually predates even glucose intolerance.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing. So we're focusing on glucose intolerance. I get lipid profiles from these people as well.
That's great.
What about the lipids and small fiber neuropathy? That's always kind of, does literature suggest high lipids?
Yeah, so the question is whether there's this phenomenon, whether you're getting small fiber, whether this is pre-diabetic.
The chicken and the egg kind of thing. We don't know if they have some of the common etiology causing lipid problems and then diabetes.
Yeah.
Is it lipid causal?
It's usually during the triglycerides,
actually. Triglycerides, yes.
So the people with triglycerides, so like over 1,000, they're obviously not high risk of small fiber, right?
Right.
About 500, they're definitely at risk. I'm not quite sure what I do with the people who are like 250. Yeah, the 250 to 400.
You can't decide they're at risk for small fiber, but you can't follow them. Well, I suppose so. If I get a repeat glucose tolerance that a year or two later, it's amazing how many of them become that normal. Yeah. What they may have in common is they may be obese. And have other risk factors for dyslipidemia. There's also a risk factor for diabetes. So we don't know what came first here. It's remarkable how many dyslipidemia become diabetic and they have a neuropathy that predates glucose intolerance. The mechanism why so many patients get
neuropathy. People that you like diagnosed with proton metabolic syndrome?
Yeah, in the sense.
So the interesting thing about metabolic syndrome is based on actually low HDL, higher triglycerides, and higher fasting glucose. I don't think it's based on LDL,
though. Well, no, part of it is measuring insulin levels.
Yeah.
So insulin levels get higher even prior to glucose intolerance. Right. So now it's a spectrum of you can have dyslipidemia, increased insulin level, then slight glucose intolerance and overt diabetes. Yeah. And the way to intervene is diet and exercise, and you can sort of begin to stop the cycle.
Yeah.
But there are steps even before we get glucose intolerance.
Another question, if the GFAP antibodies are thought to have something to do with the etiology of all this, why are small non-myelinated fibers affected in small fiber neuropathy?
Well, remember, they're in Schwann cells, just like they're inside, the unmyelinated fibers are inside, they live inside a Schwann cell, inside, they're wrapped inside a Schwann cell. And the thought is that the communication between the Schwann cell and the small fiber is actually greater than it might be in a myelinated fiber because the Schwann cell is just making myelin. But here, there's also an immune connection. There's all kinds of connections. That Schwann cell is really providing the environment for the small fiber to live. So you could make a case that the back and forth communication where you don't have myelin could be greater between the Schwann cell and the small fiber.
Yeah,
But they're wrapped, they just don't have the myelin, but they're wrapped inside the Schwann cell just like a large fiber.
One more question. Are the epidermal fibers different from the sweat, the fibers going to the sweat gland?
Yeah.
They're both C fibers? Or?
They're both C fibers, but they're entirely different fiber types.
Okay. Because, you know, I've seen this discrepancy between the Q-SAR
yeah, right.
and the skin biopsy,
right.
at least an epidermal
thing. Yeah. So I think the QST might be the connection between the two. So I think we should start, I'm going to start doing more QSTs on my patients so I really get a sense, and I'm going to do the QST from, so I'd like to find out exactly where you biopsy from and make sure I do the QST from that site. See, the other thing is site to site. So the QSAR may not be done exactly in the place where you do the QST and not exactly the place where you do the biopsy.
Right.
So, and this if this is patchy, then it's a lot of the question of where you catch it.
Right.
But where do you biopsy from?
10 centimeters proximal to the lateral alveolus, and then...
That's pretty close to where we put the QSAR.
Yeah, and then about 10 centimeters distal to the greater trochanter.
Way up.
Yeah, so but we can't do sensory testing over there because our machine is set up for a digit, right? The machine, you got to actually have to put a digit in there.
No, it's just way too painful.
No, I'm not suggesting you do it. I'm just thinking out loud in terms of trying to get
to
these.
Compare the two.
It'd be nice to somehow get you know the QSAR site, the sensory site, and the biopsy site to be the same.
That
would be nice.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do that though.
Quantitative sensory in the finger would be, wouldn't it? Is it just much more?
It's just the machine is set up for a digit.
Uh-huh.
You can't put an arm in the thing.
Right.
Well,
the vibration.
The temperature is close.
Okay.
Because we use the same site for the Q-SAR for the temperature.
Okay.
The
vibration.
Vibration is set
okay.
for either the big digit or the middle finger.
Yeah, the vibration. And not all the normals are for digits.
For vibration.
Yeah. Because, 2-point discrimination would be significantly
different. Yeah. All right, I think you have to go over 15
around.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. So actually, that article.